As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is your fire.
With the power of Grayskull.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Welcome back to the Pizzcast. I'm Nick.
I'm DJ.
And we're here after Oscars. This is the first post-Oscar Pizzcast. So I think right off the bat, what did you think about the Oscars? I listened to our Pizzcast again, and I thought it was highly informative and slightly inflammatory towards Terrence Malick. And, you know, editing it was a blast because as I was editing it, I was watching the spikes, and every time it would spike, like the audio would get all choppy, and it's all spiking because I'm yelling at Matt Foster.
And then Matt's yelling back.
So it was a fun thing to edit. But what did you think about the Oscars? I mean, I think we got a lot of the stuff right when we were looking back.
We were really close on, even the ones we missed, we were still, they were ones we said, well, if this doesn't happen, this will. So yeah. I think...
So what you're saying is that we're gods.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there weren't any huge surprises. I think probably the biggest surprise of the night was Meryl Streep over Viola Davis. By the time the Oscars aired, I was really convinced Viola was going to take it, and didn't work out that way. But that was really...
I think we both agree that that was the one thing that we would have liked to see.
Yeah,
I mean, besides the eventual Best Picture, like any other artist, any other actress in that category had a case and maybe even should have won.
Yeah, it was a solid category. But yeah, I mean, other than that, it was kind of as expected, unfortunately, because I would have liked to have seen Hugo.
Yeah, I think
take everything.
We were both really rooting for Hugo for Best Film and Picture and ended up going to The Artist for both. But at the same time, I think we both saw that coming. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't a surprise.
That wasn't a surprise. It was just in the last minutes. I hoped there would have been a surge for Hugo or even The Descendants. I mean, either one of those, I would have rather seen win.
Yeah, we were talking about beforehand, and I remember as soon as The Descendants won Best Screenplay, I'm like, that they're getting Tarantino'd from Pulp Fiction, because I remember Tarantino getting up there and going, this is the only award I'm going to receive tonight.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, don't think that, Quentin. You can win. Being young and naive. But once they won Best Screenplay, like, that's it. They're not going to win anything else for that. And I thought it was really entertaining. I was really surprised at Billy Crystal making the show.
Entertaining?
Watchable. Yeah. It made it a fast 3.5-hour broadcast.
Yeah, it did go by. That's the fastest I ever think the Oscars have gone by. And, I mean, I expected and was hoping it would be a little faster than usual because of the lack of both the lack of nominees in Best Song and the fact that they weren't performing. But then they added little things in, like the Cirque du Soleil performance. And, I mean, you'll never hear me complain about montages at the Oscars because it's one of my favorite parts of it. That's we're there to honor movies, so throw in as many montages as you can. So those I don't mind. But the Cirque du Soleil thing was cool. I just expected them to kind of streamline the show without songs. And I guess that still hurried things along because it wasn't as long as 5 song nominees would have been. But it did go by really quick.
And I thought that even the movie montages, which sometimes can be laborious to get through, they all fit the theme of the show.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they were entertaining, and the way they were having the film stars like Adam Sandler, from Adam Sandler to Ralph Fiennes, talking about why they like movies. I thought
they seemed to really be honest. It was a lot of well-known stars. People I'm a big fan of were on there. And nobody seemed to be kind of just like making it up or being, I guess, overly sentimental about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed to be honest sentiment about why they love the movies. So I thought it was that particular montage I thought was really well done.
Well, as we were talking about, we both suspected that The Artist was going to win, but neither of us liked that choice. We both think it should have been either Hugo or The Descendants, which puts The Artist and another film in a long line of films that won Best Film that were frankly not the best film of that year. And that brings us...
A very long line.
There's at least 10. Possibly 20. Possibly more, because there's been 83 Best Pictures. So today what we're going to do is we're going to break down some of the biggest snubs, quote fingers, about the films that should have won that didn't win because the artists of the world won instead. And, you know, we've had some help from...
or sometimes not even the artist of that year. Sometimes yeah. Something
lesser. Sometimes it's the American Pie of that
year. Nominated.
Oh, we'll get to Crash. So we had some help from not only friends, but also from some websites. Entertainment Weekly, the week of the Oscars, put together a great list of...
Yeah, the most overrated.
Overrated best film winners. And I think we should start with that. You had some made some notes from that that original list.
Yeah, they went way far back to the 40s, which it still shocks me to this day that Citizen Kane didn't win Best Picture that year, given how groundbreaking it was at the time. And just, I mean, obviously you can't award something for what it will do down the line, but.
If we could go back in a DeLorean, if we can get into our DeLorean, go 88 miles an hour,
and change
we would change it.
But it still just shocks me that Citizen Kane was not a Best Picture winner. However, Casablanca was, so at least they got that one right. But I thought the list was really well done, which is a huge compliment to Entertainment Weekly, considering it's Entertainment Weekly.
And sometimes they are hit and miss with their lists.
Yeah, but I thought this... I can't say it was dead on because I was shocked when I finished the list in Titanic, which should be number one on that list, if not tied for number one with Crash. I don't see how you do an overrated Best Picture list and Titanic isn't even on there. I mean, I've never ever spoken to anyone and had that conversation about the 97 Oscars and ever heard anyone say, oh yeah, Titanic deserved it.
Can you still believe the Titanic won that? That's usually how that conversation
goes. Yeah, and I mean, to people who don't, you know, who aren't as into movies as we are and don't pay attention or really understand the whole filmmaking aspect and just out of pure entertainment, even they'll say, you know, I mean, you look at the other movies that year and no matter, I mean, I think any of the other movies nominated that year are better than Titanic, but I mean, for me, LA Confidential, no contest.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I think we both agree on that. We'll get to that later on. I was surprised that they put the English Patient on that list. Because I remember loving The English Patient and comparing it to other films nominated for that year. And I really did feel it was the best film. Like, okay, yeah, it was a little bit long in the flashbacks. But I thought it was a film that really mirrored what kind of a poetic story it was. And, you know, considering what type of, the book itself is kind of a stream of consciousness book and how it was able to tell that story, I thought was really well done. So I was a little surprised to see that on the list.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I mean, just thinking back from memory out of all the ones I remember from the list, I would say that would be the least overrated Best Picture winner for me on that list. 'Cause that was one that, I mean, I was 16 when that won Best Picture, and I just think back to that year, and that was like a no... I mean, Seinfeld did an episode about it. Like, that was a no contest. That's cleaning up at the awards, or at least taking Best Picture.
And it's a great Seinfeld episode, too.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yep.
You know, when Seinfeld puts his mark on anything, it's going to be good. The Yankees. Kenny Rogers chicken. So then, I think we were both talking, we were going over this list of all the past decades of Oscar winners. And we're looking through the 70s to kind of see where we should start. And we both found that the 70s are a very tough year. Like, all the films that won Best Picture.
The Oscars, I mean, the 70s is my favorite decade for film anyway, because it was, I mean, if there was ever a game changer, I mean, that was it. And the Oscars or the Academy really knew what they were doing that year. I mean, every single year I'd be hard-pressed to argue any of the choices.
Yeah.
And not only... And I mean, any of those years you have at least two, if not three films that very easily could have taken Best Picture. But the ones that did, I think it's tough to tough to argue, as much as I'd like to make a case for Star Wars over Annie Hall. It's really tough to argue with any of the choices.
You know, I think specifically 74, Godfather Part II, Chinatown, and The Conversation. How can one of those films be better than the other?
The Conversation is a little lesser known, I would say, out of those three movies to the general public. But those are three of the greatest films to come out of the 70s,
yeah.
Which basically means they're three of the greatest films ever made.
And so, two of them by Coppola.
Yeah, and two of them, yeah. So, and that's, you know, everybody kind of rags on Coppola at times. And, you know, what did he do after the 80s? You know, Apocalypse Now was his last great film. But it doesn't matter. Because if you have The Godfather 2, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now on your filmography, you can retire. And you're still one of the greatest directors ever.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter.
I would like to see a new Coppola film just because I would like to see a new Coppola film. But at the same time, you know, I don't want my bubble of Coppola to be popped.
Yeah.
Especially when you go back and you watch Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, how timeless is that film? Because it's talking about this new age of warfare that started with Vietnam that, you know, we're still going on today with Afghanistan. And I think maybe he didn't realize it was going to be such a timeless piece, but it's become...
Yeah.
It's become an amazing piece of cinema and storytelling.
Yeah, and I mean, he's gone and done his own thing the last few years, and he just makes really small, personal movies that he finances himself, and I say more power to him. Like, it's... Yeah. And even the stuff he did, like, The Outsiders is great, and look at how many stars came out of that movie, and the guy's had a very solid career over the years, but, you know, I get into conversations with people sometimes about kind of his status as one of the greatest living directors. And those four movies alone do it.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't matter what he did post Apocalypse Now, because he made those four films in less than 10 years basically a 10 year span. So,
and somehow still stayed sane.
Well, that's debatable. If you watch the documentary, yeah, Apocalypse Now. Kind of lost it there for a little while.
The Apocalypse Now documentary, maybe my favorite. One of my favorite documentaries ever made.
Oh, absolutely.
If nothing for the first 10 minutes of the film where they're talking about how Martin Sheen's character was playing depressed, suicidal, and drugged out of his mind. And Martin Sheen was actually crazy, depressed, and drugged out of his mind. Let's start with the 80s then, since we've both figured that there's a lot starting in the 80s and going to the 90s that we can make notes on. And the first one, starting off with 1980... How was Raging Bull not winning Best Picture?
Raging, and granted, I've never seen Ordinary People. I know enough about it, I feel, to say what I'm about to say. But Raging Bull not winning Best Picture is one of the biggest Academy oversights. I would say top three Academy oversights ever for Best Picture. Because, I mean, it's just... I would consider Hugo one of Scorsese's masterpieces, but Raging Bull might be his absolute masterpiece.
I've never seen Ordinary People either, but when I talk about Scorsese, and I love Scorsese. I love Goodfellas, you know, I really like The Departed, I love Casino, but Raging Bull is as perfect as a film as, you know, we talk about Apocalypse Now with Coppola. Raging Bull is as perfect as a film he's ever made.
Yep.
As, you know, and it's mind-blowing that you go back and like, oh, that's the best film of 1980, and you go back and look on Wikipedia, and no, it wasn't the best film.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best, that might be the best film of the 80s, period.
Like, yeah.
And, I mean, it's a textbook on filmmaking, it's a textbook on acting. I don't get how...
And cinematography.
Everything, yeah. And I just don't get...
I think it's also...
Ordinary People.
It's also interesting
how it doesn't beat Ordinary People.
It's also interesting to note that there are two films on this list that are black and white, and everyone made a big deal about the artist being black and white.
Yeah.
That'd be The Elephant Man and Raging Bull. So then we're looking at the 80s, and not a whole lot popped up. Like, you can make arguments for Raiders of the Lost Ark...
Yeah, I had noted that, Raiders of the Lost Ark over Chariots of Fire. And again, some of this I'm hesitant to even start doing because some of these movies I haven't even seen. So I'm very hesitant to make a case for the movies I have seen and love over movies I haven't seen. But at the same time, granted, hindsight's 20/20, but I think a lot of these films, having not seen them but knowing what the argument is based on, I still am going to probably make an argument for the films I've seen, if that makes any sense at all.
It does. I guess 89, you know, Driving Miss Daisy against Born on 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, Filled with Dreams and My Left Foot. I guess that is maybe one of the first debatable years going into the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, and I can see why it won. I mean, granted, My Left Foot especially is a fantastic film. Born on the 4th of July is one of Stone's best.
I think it's one of my favorite Stone films,
Born on the 4th of July. But I remember being, 9, 10 years old and seeing Driving Miss Daisy when it came out and just getting it. Like, that was one of the first movies that I was like, oh, this is why movies win awards. Like, and for, you know, for a 10-year-old, and that was long before I developed my obsession with movies. I guess I've always been obsessed with movies, but long before I really got into it, like, that one I got. I would have loved to have seen Field of Dreams win, but is that what they said for Moneyball? That Moneyball's only the second baseball movie to ever be nominated?
Yeah, which surprised me, because I thought The Natural would have been up there, too.
Yeah.
Because The Natural, I think The Natural's the best baseball film.
Yeah.
Ever made. And I love Field of Dreams, but I have a deep baseball obsession when it comes to The Natural.
Yeah.
How well it's filmed, all the acting, the writing, the cinematography. And then if you go into you start reading kind of like the liner notes of the movie about how, you know, it doesn't end the way it ends in the book. Yep. And the author of the book's totally fine with that. He actually thinks it's a better ending than the movie. But that's on the list anyway. You know, if you look back at Driving Miss Daisy and you think that it's the first film, like you said, that you got as a 10-year-old, and it really has a very wide appeal rate.
Yeah.
It, like, you cannot watch that movie and say, I hated Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's the kind of the separating point between that and Born on the 4th of July and Dead Poets Society, is that you can very easily not like Dead Poets Society.
Yeah,
Very easily.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy it, but I can definitely... My mom hates it. And I can definitely see the argument for hating Dead Poets Society.
My boss hates Field of Dreams. Yeah. You even mentioned Field of Dreams, and she goes crazy about it because she doesn't get... She I guess it's the suspension of disbelief that she's lacking, and she doesn't get what the big deal is.
I hope your boss doesn't listen to this.
It's people just want... I doubt it. But, no, I mean, I've told her. Like,
yeah.
So I can see with those other movies, whereas you're right, Driving Miss Daisy just kind of covers all bases. And it's
really on one hand, it's safe, but on the other hand, it's really well done.
Yep.
Which brings us to 1990. You know, this begins the Kevin Costner making 7-hour movies-a-thon. Dances with Wolves wins over Awakenings, over Ghost, over Godfather Part 3, and over Goodfellas. And, I mean, I love Dances with Wolves. I really enjoyed it in the theater. I think I saw it when I was, 12 or 13. And I remember, maybe that was the first Academy Award show that I watched all the way through. And I remember thinking, hey, that was a big movie. I can understand why we wouldn't Best Picture. It's a lot of epicness to it. And then later on in life, seeing Awakenings and seeing Goodfellas.
Yeah.
I'm like, how are those not winning that award? And I guess you can make the argument for Goodfellas. If there's one problem I have with Scorsese, with Goodfellas, and with Casino, and with The Departed too, it's somewhere between the second and third act he loses it. Like, he tries to put so much stuff in there, and then it becomes... It's always jumbled. It seems a mess. And I feel that way every time I watch Goodfellas, and I love Goodfellas. But I always feel like when it's coming to the end, it really starts to slow down, and it really starts to not so much become a different movie, but it doesn't keep up with the same tempo that it had been with.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I remember I watched Awakenings, and I still will watch Awakenings. I think Awakenings is a brilliant film.
Yep.
I know it's based on a true story, and we'll get to true stories and stories that are messed up. And I mean, I don't know how true it is to it. And the same thing with Goodfellas. You hear all the rumors about Henry Hill, and like, was he half a wise guy, or was he as epic as he says he was in the book? But looking back on it, I think maybe both those films are better than Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen Dances with Wolves, but I mean, yeah, I can't argue Dances with Wolves over Goodfellas. I mean, I just don't. That's another one I just don't get how it happened. And Awakenings. And what were the other ones then?
Ghost and Godfather Part 3.
I mean, The Godfather Part 3 is nowhere close to being on par with the other two.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to think if I were to rewatch Dances with Wolves, I would side on The Godfather Part 3 over it as well.
I would just throw Ghost out. I didn't like Ghost.
I love Ghost, but just not as a best picture. And Whoopi won Best Supporting Actress that year for it, and it's a great performance. But yeah, mm-hmm. I can't see Ghost, in the, especially up against those. But
and then we go through. So I mean, I think we both say Goodfellas should have won that year.
Yep.
This is the should have won podcast. 91, we have no problem with Silence of the Lambs winning.
Absolutely.
92, we have no problem with Unforgiven.
Nope.
93, I mean, if you don't give it to Schindler's List. Then
yeah, what else is nominated? I was reading through that list. The Fugitive.
The Fugitive and The Name of the Father, The Piano, and Remains of the Day.
Yeah, I mean,
so you have two period pieces. You have three period pieces.
In The Name of the Father is fantastic, but, I mean, it's Schindler's List. There's no...
Would you say that Schindler's List the best film made in the last 30 years?
No, but we'll get to that later, too.
94.
It's one of them.
But it's one of them.
I would not say it's the best.
94, you have, I think this is where we're going to kind of stop and talk about the next batch of movies. Forrest Gump wins. The other nominees are Four Weddings and a Funeral, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and Shawshank Redemption.
I kind of wish we had, like, and I know the listeners couldn't see this, but I wish we had a screen of, like, Minority Report in front of us where we could just, like, take the ones we want to throw out and throw them off to, like, the trash can inside.
Break them.
That's what I'm imagining in my head as I'm saying this, because I can say right off the bat, I would throw out Four Weddings and a Funeral. And what was the other one?
Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and Shawshank.
And we were discussing this earlier. Actually, I'm okay with Quiz Show staying in there given the time. I don't think it's a film that's held up as well, which you and I were discussing before we started recording. But given the time it came out and was nominated, and it did have a lot of buzz around it. I'm okay with that in there. Four Weddings and a Funeral, I think, was just kind of...
I would like to go back and see what movies came out in 94 that were highly rated.
Yeah.
I mean, highly... not rated. Highly reviewed. And see why was Four Weddings nominated. I mean, Four Weddings is my favorite romantic... That's when I realized I like romantic comedies, with Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Well, it's because, and I guess I can see why, because that was the first kind of British invasion romantic comedy. And you look at the other movies, like, if you want to do a romantic comedy right, the guys that made Four Weddings and a Funeral are the guys you go to.
Yeah.
Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Love Actually, they know how to do a well-made romantic comedy.
British romantic comedy,
yeah.
For an American audience.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess I can see where that would have come from, but...
But I think, personally, you know, this is so hard. I mean, I love Forrest Gump, but, you know, Pulp Fiction was so groundbreaking, and even if you want to argue, I mean, Reservoir Dogs was better, you don't want to make that argument?
Never. No.
Really?
Yeah, I still think Pulp Fiction is Tarantino's masterpiece.
I need to rewatch both, because that's something I really go back and forth on, is Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction.
Reservoir Dogs, I think, for me, watching Reservoir Dogs, you can see the birth of Tarantino's genius,
mm-hmm.
but Pulp Fiction is full on, like, establishing it.
Yeah.
And I love Forrest Gump. Groundbreaking special effects. A great kind of, somewhat modern fairy tale. But the movie industry just isn't the same without Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And not even the movie industry. Film in general it was the rise of independent film. And I think that it was obvious how much of a game changer it was going to be that year. So again, and I mean, it was obviously going with kind of sentiment over substance.
Yeah.
That year, but
that was definitely sentiment over substance.
Yeah, as much as I love Forrest Gump, that's another one where I just don't get how Pulp Fiction doesn't walk away with Best Picture.
Really? So you even put Pulp Fiction over Shawshank?
Absolutely. Because I love Shawshank, but in terms of being a film, Shawshank, I would say, is being a great film, Shawshank is slightly overrated for me because it's not better than The Godfather.
And is that the litmus test?
Yeah, and that's IMDb, the top 250 always goes between number one, The Godfather, and Shawshank. And Shawshank's a great movie. I love Shawshank. And because I get in arguments with people because they're not really understanding what I'm saying. I'm not saying I dislike Shawshank,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's gotten overrated in over the years in terms of how great of a film it actually is. And I think people are mistaking how the film makes you feel versus how well the film's actually made. And I can't stress it enough how much I loved The Shawshank Redemption, mm-hmm. but that's where the Academy, I think, showed some foresight, because The Shawshank Redemption was a flop when it came out. Nobody yeah. saw it. Nobody. So to nominate for Best Picture, and then, you know, once it came out on video, that's where it gained an audience and hit TV and gained even more of an audience.
Yeah.
And it's become the classic it is today, which is a way, the way some great movies kind of earn their classic title. Same with It's a Wonderful Life, just for a comparison. But, again, given filmmaking and what it did at the time, and for argument purposes, what it's done since, I still have to go with Pulp Fiction.
That's an interesting. I would go with
The Shawshank Redemption over Forrest Gump.
Mm-hmm.
If Pulp Fiction wasn't in the category. But because I think with Forrest Gump, it's really the special effects that, I mean, those I think still hold up.
I think the special effects I think you're right. The special effects in Forrest Gump are 3/4 of the film. Like there's not one scene in that film that isn't altered
right.
by special effects. And it's kind of like this, like all the buzz about how, you know, they cut off Lieutenant Dan's legs yep. and
inserting him
with Kennedy's. Yep. I think we're talking about the emotionality of a film. The Forrest Gump has that same type of feel. Like you feel something in Forrest Gump, and like you have like this feeling like this is the best picture,
right?
Because of all these great things happening to such a simple man as the story, and then it's backed up with, you know, Zemeckis' brilliance at developing technology.
Yep.
And making a film with it. And it's funny, if you look at these films, Forrest Gump is the only film that, I mean, now at the time, Miramax is, I mean, it's independent in name only.
Yeah.
You know, but at the time, Paramount and Columbia with Shawshank, but even Columbia now doesn't really exist. Castle Rock Entertainment's, I think, only distribution now.
Yeah.
So Paramount's the only major studio on this list. And it's Forrest Gump is the biggest film of the year. Yeah. But as far as, you know, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, Shawshank, Four Weddings, Shawshank was a bomb. Pulp Fiction, moderate success. Quiz Show, indie.
Well, I think Pulp Fiction was, considering the budget, a huge success for what it grossed. But, yeah, they're all smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, Shawshank was, yeah, Forrest Gump's the only, like, huge movie of that, of those nominated. Yeah.
I think you make a great poll. I think I need to go back. I haven't said this. I love Pulp Fiction. I haven't seen Pulp Fiction in so long. I think you're right when it comes to Shawshank. When it comes to Shawshank, maybe it's just my emotional attachment to it. And, you know, maybe the fact that I can quote it word for word the entire yeah. film is why I think it's a great film.
No, Shawshank is absolutely a great film.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it just drives me crazy when people start comparing it to... See, with me, when I'm asked what my favorite movie is, I always, and we've had this conversation before, I think, I always ask, do you want my favorite film or what I think is the best film ever made?
Yeah.
Because there's a huge difference.
So I think that's when people argue for they're arguing for their favorite film to be considered the greatest film ever made. And there's a long line of films that I think come before Shawshank on the list of greatest films ever made. Mm-hmm. But I totally understand why anybody would have it as their favorite film.
I would agree with that, absolutely.
And that's the only reason I say
Pulp Fiction wins. Yeah.
Pulp Fiction wins. And I'm not necessarily saying, I guess, Shawshank's overrated. I'm saying Shawshank as the greatest film ever made is overrated.
But can you put in that pretext? Like, looking back on it now, almost 30. Jesus. No, 20.
20.
Okay, a few. As we prove again in this podcast, I'm bad with math. You know, as we come across almost 20 years now of Shawshank Redemption, this is the 18th year since it came out, is it because we're looking back on it with that,
and that's
our favorite film, and right. At the time, you know, do you put it up against Forrest Gump and Quiz Show and Pulp Fiction? Even Quiz Show, watching it recently, you know, the story is not 100%, you know, on the up and up. But, you know, I think Quiz Show is a weird how it kind of holds up, and then it doesn't.
It doesn't, yeah.
Yeah. It still looks amazing. And the acting
is still
Ralph Fiennes is still an amazing character in it. But I remember watching it probably when it came out on video afterwards and thinking, oh, it's a really good film. Then watching it, you know, no less than 6 months ago and thinking, it's not as good as I remember it.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, I saw it when I was probably, I don't know, 16,
mm-hmm.
Probably once in my early 20s again, and then have since just seen it in the last 6 months. And I think it's probably just because I've seen so many other films since that it's kind of just lost whatever luster it had originally.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Pulp Fiction is my vote for that.
Pulp
year.
Fiction,
yeah.
Hands down, Pulp Fiction. You hear that, Academy? DJ says you're wrong in 94. 95, Braveheart wins over Apollo 13, Babe, The Postman, and Invincibility. I have no problem with that.
No problem.
His historical inaccuracy be damned.
Yeah,
well, that was a very good film.
that's the thing. No movie. Well, this brings up an interesting topic. I've always thought the word's pronounced biopic, but the other day, my girlfriend and I were watching something where whoever was announcing it said it biopic. And I'm not sure.
I've always thought it was biopic, too.
I thought it was biopic. So we'll go with biopic for this, for this podcast. But find me a biopic that's been the actual story that happened, because they don't exist. I mean, it just
doesn't
exist.
Also, a very boring movie.
Right. Any one of those movies is Hollywoodized.
Yeah.
So at this point, if they get most of the story right, if I know most of the story, then I'm okay with it. And Braveheart's just so good that I don't mind the kind of revisionist history.
It really, I mean, and I love Apollo 13, and, you know, Babe has a very special place in my heart. But Braveheart,
yeah,
you know, hands down, produced, directed, written, starring. You know, there's one thing that crazy Mel Gibson did when he wasn't so crazy, was Braveheart.
Yep.
1996, English Patient wins. We were talking about this earlier. I remember watching English Patient and for the first time thinking, that's the best film of the year. And I was probably only 16, 17. And then it's up against Fargo, Jerry Maguire, Secrets and Lies, and Shine. And I am okay with the English Patient winning. I still think it's a good pick. Entertainment Weekly disagrees with me. But I need to see Shine again. But the more I think about Shine, it's just as good of a film.
Yeah.
As that.
And I mean, I love Jerry Maguire and Fargo, but I don't think either one of them really overall is best picture. And I've never seen Secrets and Lies.
I still haven't.
Yeah.
It's been years. I still haven't seen that film.
But yeah, I'm perfectly okay with the English Patient winning.
And now we come to our favorite year of all, 1997, where the winner was Titanic, and it was against As Good As It Gets, The Full Monty, Good Will Hunting, LA Confidential. I would say that all four of those films are better than Titanic.
Absolutely. I mean,
Titanic's the only film of a problem winning Best Picture in 97.
Yep. Again, I'm actually not knocking Titanic. It's an unbelievably well-made movie. But it's not... for me, Best Picture has to have basically every aspect of the filmmaking firing on all cylinders. And be the best example of filmmaking of that year.
Yeah.
And it's just not when it comes to story, much like my issues with The Artist. I mean, the love story's weak. The story overall is weak.
Yeah.
It's shoehorning in a fictional story on this very historical event of these characters that never existed.
Yeah.
And it's just, which is great if you can do that and make it a compelling story, which Cameron did overall, but it's a special effects movie.
Yeah.
So if you're not going to award it to Star Wars, or if you're not going to award Best Picture to, Star Wars or Jaws or something like that, then why are you giving it to Titanic just because it at the time spent more money on special effects than any other movie ever did? And
I guess to James Cameron's credit, and this is kind of why I thought he was going to win for Avatar the same token, was that he created technology for that film.
Right.
And it was what he did with Avatar 2, where I was convinced, I didn't think Avatar was the best picture, because like Titanic, it has a lot of story problems and acting problems. But, you know, it created technology. It created a brand new way that films are going to be making, are going to be made like this forever. And, you know, Titanic, you know, before this, it was Forrest Gump, and films were made like Forrest Gump using that special effects. And then Titanic came, and then everyone was using the head of a scope.
Yeah. And it wasn't the first time Cameron had done that. He did it with The Abyss. He did it again with T2. And honestly, I think Terminator 2 is a better film than Titanic. Overall, I mean,
my problem with Titanic is, like you said, it's the story is really weak. It's, you know, it's a love story. It's not even a good love story.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of Romeo and Juliet-ish without without being Shakespeare.
But even Romeo and Juliet was better.
Yeah.
Well, I think so. I know you're no fan of Bass, but
the story was better.
The only positive thing about, I shouldn't say that because I don't hate Titanic. I just hate how much of an overrated film it's become.
I would agree with that sentiment exactly. I enjoyed Titanic.
Yeah. I enjoyed it for what it was.
I started once and then twice.
My favorite part about Titanic is the fact that DiCaprio and Winslet made a movie together years later, and to see the difference in their acting and the chemistry that they do have, and how well they act together. I don't think I would have enjoyed Revolutionary Road as much as I did had Titanic not existed.
Yeah.
So for me, that's the best part of Titanic.
And to see how much the acting has changed.
Yeah, and how, like, they've both grown as actors, but still have...
I'm trying to think if that was the first time I've ever seen Kate Winslet was in Titanic. I feel like there was something
that
else.
That was the first time,
I had seen her in. But, you know, to see her... And... It's a great starting place for both of them because they both kind of were there. I mean, DiCaprio did Basketball Diaries and
What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
And also the Romeo and Juliet.
Yep, and This Boy's Life. He'd been on since he'd been making movies here and there since Growing Pains. Yeah. So.
But at the same time, this is the first time he actually showed a star quality.
Right, and that
and. To watch them grow, and now I would argue he's one of the best actors.
I would say both him and Winslet are
Winslet's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they're two of the best actors in the business today. They're two of my favorites. So, and that's, I think that speaks more to how overrated Titanic is, because DiCaprio and Winslet are sellers for me. Anything they're in, it's worth seeing just because of them.
But they're so green in that.
And the fact, like, that they're in that together, and I haven't seen it since it first came out in 97... I think says something, but...
But we're not going to give it the Titanic. Titanic should not have won Best Picture. You know, you can make arguments for As Good As It Gets, for The Full Monty, which is one of my favorite films, and also it's kind of going along with that whole English...
comedy.
Yep. English comedy, the takeover they were talking about with Four Weddings. You know, you can say that for Good Will Hunting, too. It was probably Good Will Hunting was probably more of a favorite than any other films besides Titanic. L.A. Confidential, to me, is still the best picture of 1997.
And going back to what you said earlier about Schindler's List, L.A. Confidential, to me, is, if not the greatest, one of the absolute greatest films, American films, of the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. Going back to that cinema revolution of the 70s, L.A. Confidential is filmmaking I mean, it's like Raging Bull. It's a, for me, it's a perfect film.
It's every, absolutely perfect.
When you, if you've ever read the book and you see how much of that story was cut down.
Yeah. It's, I did read the book and I was amazed.
Yeah. And I think the film is far and away better than the book.
I agree.
And it just tightens everything up in the book. I mean, it takes the essential aspects of the book and tells the story better than the book does, I think.
And every performance in that is spot on.
Yeah.
Like, it's Kevin Spacey. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that, help me, Gladiator.
Russell Crowe.
Russell Crowe wins, should have won. He wasn't even nominated.
No.
But yeah, he should have won for anybody, L.A. Confidential.
I mean, any of those three leads should have been Guy nominated. Pierce. Should have won. Yeah. You've got James Cromwell. I mean, Kim Basinger did win, and her part's like 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she's great in it. But of all the performances in that movie, for her to walk away with an Oscar is kind of a head-scratcher.
Still mind-boggling.
And, I mean, just the supporting cast, everybody in it is...
Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And, it, I mean, it's shot in such a great throwback to film noir.
Yep.
You know, the use of shadows, the use of story, L.A. Confidential, I remember I started with my dad and we were both blown away. Just what a perfect film it was. And so when it came time for Titanic to eventually win, I kind of knew at that point, you know, that was when I'm starting to read Entertainment Weekly and starting to know more about voting of it. I knew it wasn't going to win, but I was really hoping somehow in some miracle it would.
Yeah, and it's that, that's the one that I just don't get and never will understand, because...
So it's the void year. We don't.
The year we will not speak.
The year is Voldemort. It's
one
the year
of two. Voldemort.
The next year, Shakespeare in Love wins over Elizabeth. Life is Beautiful. Saving Private Ryan and The Thin Red Line. We know Matt Foster hates The Thin Red Line.
Yep.
This is one we were talking about before. How I'm torn. I really like Shakespeare in Love, and I remember I didn't see it until afterward won. And so I remember watching Saving Private Ryan in the theaters and thinking, that is an amazing piece of filmmaking. That's going to win the Oscar. And then being so heartbroken and like upset, like viscerally upset when it lost Shakespeare in Love. And then seeing Shakespeare in Love, I'm like, okay, I can understand why it would win Best Picture.
I can't.
Really?
And I love Shakespeare in Love, but it took me...
I think this is going to go to the argument we have later on, coming up later on too, about the scope. I think this is a scope argument.
Because this, I mean... I love Shakespeare in Love, but it's just not on the same level of filmmaking, I feel, as Private Ryan is. And it's, I mean, the Academy hates Spielberg. They, you know, as much as they've given him with Schindler's List and Best Director for Private Ryan, his stuff usually doesn't get nominated. I was shocked that War Horse was in this year. He's just not, for some reason, he's not an Academy favorite. But then again, neither Scorsese.
Yeah.
But I just, I mean, and again, both at the time and now, I don't see how it goes to Shakespeare in Love. And I love Shakespeare in Love, but I just don't, it's, for me, it's, comparing those two, it's fluff versus art. And Shakespeare in Love is certainly art on some level, but if I have to label one fluff and one art, that's getting fluff.
Really? I thought you were going to go the other way around.
No, because Private Ryan, I put Private Ryan up against Schindler's List as Spielberg's masterpiece. It's the way they process the film. It's the way they did everything to it in terms of filmmaking.
And by no means am I disparaging Saving Private Ryan. Like, I will still watch that movie to get... I mean, and we were watching it like 2 months ago. It came on TNT. I will sit through the commercials and the awful dubbing and watch it. It's a great, great film. But, you know what? I think Saving Private Ryan has, you know, some flaws in its story.
Oh,
I think that I mean, the acting's incredible. And, like, the cinematography and what they did. A lot like Titanic. Like, you know, how they developed this technology that's used so... it was used sparingly up to then, and now everyone seems to use the way they, you know, every war film made for Saving Private Ryan
looks like Private
used, Ryan. Looks like Private Ryan.
Especially Eastwood's.
Yeah. But I think Saving Private Ryan, I think this, for me, the story is still, it's weak, and it kind of falls off. You know, I understand what they're going with at the end with you know, Matt Damon, Ryan going to Arlington and scene, but like that, it's not necessary. You know, I just find the dialogue is great, but there's something about the story that always falls apart for me when I watch it that it doesn't hold up as well as the story for Schindler's List does. And I feel Shakespeare in Love, you know, it's a romantic comedy, but at the same time, its story, it's consistent in the way that it's written and the plot devices it uses. It's consistently really well written all the way through. But then again, you have the Thin Red Line, which, you know, I think this is the first time in 98 that you really see such a disparity about how the war in Europe and also the war in the Pacific is fought and how it makes people feel.
Yeah.
I think it's also a really good indicator when you look at Saving Private Ryan and compare it to Band of Brothers, the HBO miniseries. It's a lot of the time the same, not only the way it's shot, but also the same sentiment as, you know, like, no one likes war, war is hell. But it's like, war is hell, let's go get them, boys, and buying the cigar like the guys from S.H.I.E.L.D. and Captain America. Yeah. It's like kind of like, we'll do it for the greater good. Whereas you look at the Thin Red Line and then, you know, almost 15 years later with the Pacific on HBO, and it really tells a different story that, like, this isn't, like, war is hell, period. End of sentence. Like, there's nothing beautiful about this. It's,
But you think that's Private Ryan, you feel, is, like, the cigar chomping?
Yeah.
Really?
I get that. I get... Really?
Yeah. From the opening scene, I think everything in that opening... Not the opening scene, because I think the opening scene is the family going to Arlington. But the
opening scene is the family going to Arlington?
Yeah.
Is it open that way?
Yeah. It's walking there. And,
I totally
and
forgot.
And then it cuts back to old Ryan. But this D-Day scene in Private Ryan, I think, is... I mean, that's everything I'd ever need to... know and not want to know about what war seemed to be like. And to later on in the film with Hanks just talking about wanting to go home and the only thing he wants to do is see his wife. And even Matt Damon, which I just read the other day, was totally an improv scene talking about his memories of his brothers back home. I think all that...
That was an amazing scene.
...builds to the fact that none of these... guys wanted to be there, want to be there, want anything to do with this, and they're just doing what they need to do until they can get home. Which I haven't finished Band of Brothers yet. I actually still have to see some of it, but I see what you're talking about in Band of Brothers more than I see it in Ryan. But yeah,
I don't mean that to say that you know, Saving Private Ryan's a feel good film. Like it's a tearjerker. You know, I don't mean to sound like that's what I'm going with. But I feel there's definitely a more of a sense of camaraderie in Band of Brothers. I mean, in Saving Private Ryan that you see again in Band of Brothers.
Okay.
And you know, I like that a lot. I love the filmmaking aspect of Saving Private Ryan. If I'm splitting hairs, I think the story's a little weak.
Okay.
So that's why for me, I mean, I love Shakespeare in Love. I think deserves that, but I can. Honestly, it's one of those, like, split of hairs. Like, why did that win, not Ryan?
Okay. We'll bring that back when we get to the other year. Disagree.
99, American Beauty wins over Cider House Rules, Green Mile, Insider, and Sixth Sense. We were talking this before, too. We both are okay with American Beauty winning. But, looking back on it, how did the Insider not win this award?
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I remember 1999 like it was yesterday in terms of movies because I'd reached my like full on obsession with film. I was going to the movies, you know, twice a week. I was at UMass,
which is no easy task at UMass Amherst.
No, and it was actually when both the Mountain Farms Mall and the Hampshire Mall were under construction and there was no theater at the time.
Yeah.
So we would drive out to West Springfield to go to the movies.
Which is no easy task.
Yeah. And that's for the entire fall. That's where I saw most of these movies, in Springfield or West Springfield. And
you know, I started in Springfield. I started the first Final Destination.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was one of, we were like a group of five of us, side story, five of us among, and we were half of the audience, and half of the audience was drunk. And I remember watching the scene where someone, where they spill the vodka on the computer explodes. And my friend yells out, "That's the way I want to go." And some guy behind me yells out, "This movie fucking sucks!"
That's more of Final Destination than I can even remember.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that was a UMass movie story.
So, 99 was a year that I think is one of the greatest years in film history, if you're just going to pick a year, a single year. So, as out of the films nominated, I'm okay with American Beauty winning. But the question I would pose is, should it have won given all the other films that came out that year that probably should have been nominated? Out of those lists, the ones actually nominated, yeah, I think The Insider should have beaten it. But in 99, you also had Being John Malkovich, Election, Fight Club, Boys Don't Cry, Three Kings, Magnolia, and The Matrix and Sixth Sense, which
Sixth Boys Sense Don't was Cry was that year and was nominated for Best Picture?
I think so.
I kind of swear, Boys. You're absolutely right, because I haven't seen any of the other lists. But the fact that it's nominated for Best Picture is kind of surprising.
Not nominated.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. Sorry.
And Hilary Swank won, right? That was her first Oscar. Yeah. So, yeah.
She did not win it for The Karate Kid 3. A lot of people don't know that.
Or Buffy the Vampire.
It's there.
I think The Insider should have taken it in 99, but I'd also think, I mean, ideally, I would like to see a revamped 1999 Best Picture nominee list.
With 5 or 10? Do you want to expand for 10 for 99?
I would say 5 and just trade out most of the other nominated films, because that's far from the best of 99. And granted, again, we're looking at it 13 years later. But, I mean, at the time, I remember seeing Three Kings and Fight Club, particularly in the theater, and just being blown away by both of them. Magnolia was... I couldn't even wrap my mind around Magnolia the first time I saw it. I had to see it twice before I even started to come to grips with what it was kind of encompassing. Being John Malkovich is still one of the just trippiest movies I've ever seen, and so well done. And I mean, just think back to 99 when The Matrix came out and the impact The Matrix had on, I mean, not only movies, but just kind of, I mean, you could get into the whole cultural aspect and Columbine and everything else, which is a direction I don't want to take it. But it could play into that. Not that that would be a reason to nominate for Best Picture, but the impact it had on film and just pop culture, mm-hmm. and, you know, movies that came after that, where everybody was just chasing The Matrix after that.
Yeah.
I mean, even you could even say the sequels to The Matrix are chasing The Matrix.
Yeah, and they never reach it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess my only thing in this list, gosh, you know, I think I need to see The Sixth Sense again. It's been a long time since I've seen it, and I've seen a lot of crappy M. Night Shyamalan films in between. That might be the only one. I guess maybe I have to see Green Mile, too. You know, take those two off that list and try to find room for some stuff on your list. Yeah. I think as great as Three Kings is, I don't think in any scenario it would have been nominated.
No,
Maybe now it would have with, like, revisionist history. Like, with the... I think if it was released now, it would have been. But I think, you know, the same thing with Fight Club. As much as I love Fight Club, I think Fight Club itself wasn't didn't really have a great success in the box office.
Fight Club was a total failure. Total failure.
And that was another one we talked about before.
Because, I mean, Fight Club was originally supposed to be released in either, I think, May. And once Columbine happened, they pushed it.
Yeah.
It just got lost kind of in the fall. It got pushed back twice, I think, before it was finally released in October 99.
You know, I think that's the first year you look at those indie film, like, you know, I know that Fight Club is not an indie film, but it, in a lot of ways, it is.
Indie sensibility.
Yeah, it's an indie sensibility, and I'm not sure if people were ready to give indie films that challenge authority that much.
Yeah.
Any credit at all. I think those three films, Being John Malkovich, Three Kings, and Fight Club, all I have two of them are actual indie films, but they're all they're not ready. The Academy wasn't ready to recognize that type of filmmaking.
Yeah,
that type of like new age avant-garde filmmaking.
Yep, I would agree with that. And it's funny, The Sixth Sense. I love The Sixth Sense, but for me, The Sixth Sense is a movie that once you've seen it and once you've had that surprise ending, the movie's never as good as that first.
None of his films are, because now you're expecting it every time.
But whereas Fight Club, which is a movie that also has a surprise ending, the movie still holds up. I can still watch that movie, and I find new things about it each time. And there's movies that have a surprise ending that I think are like both, that I can watch over and over again years later, and it still has an impact, even though I know the ending. Or it's like The Sixth Sense factor, where I know the ending's coming, and it's never as good as that first time. Even though I still enjoy the movie, it's still never as good.
I think with Fight Club, there are so many nuanced parts of Fight Club that you can look back, knowing the secret, and see where it fits in.
Yeah.
Whereas Sixth Sense, they're not saying there aren't nuanced parts of it, but it's not as many. Right. Like, there are five or six times when you can say, you can see how the ending of Fight Club would affect a certain scene. I mean, the ending of Sixth Sense affected certain parts of the film, but as far as once you've seen the, and they're very in your face.
Yeah.
Like, once you've seen those five or six parts where, you know, she's not talking to Bruce Willis, and how come she's not recognizing he's there, once you've gotten over that, and the color reds and everything, you're kind of over the mystery. Whereas, same with Fight Club, there are so many little things, especially after you read the book and you listen to the commentary, that you pick on that you wouldn't even have noticed.
Yeah. Where it's almost like M. Night is trying to hide the fact of the ending the whole time, doing everything he can to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Fincher's almost putting it in plain sight, and we're just not smart enough to grasp it. I mean, down to the inserting Brad Pitt five times subliminally. Yeah. Like, and all the other things that you can catch. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's one's sleight of hand and the other's like, I'm fooling you because you're not fast enough to catch up to me.
2000, Gladiator wins. I really, really enjoyed Gladiator. I thought it was a great movie. I said with my dad, it's one of the few films that I've saw, like, I think I saw it three times in theaters. You know, once by myself, once with my dad, and once again with, like, a friend of mine. Gladiator is a guy's Titanic.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed Gladiator, but it should not have won Best Picture, and he should not have won Best Actor for it. I mean, that Best Actor he got for Gladiator is for The Insider and for The Complete Stunt for LA Confidential. Yeah. And I have no idea why Gladiator wins Best Picture over Traffic, or even over, well, over Traffic.
I mean, I think Traffic is certainly a stronger film. And I mean, I love Gladiator. I actually remember walking out of Gladiator and being like, yeah, I liked it, but Braveheart's better.
Yeah.
And now I would say Gladiator's the better film than Braveheart. Having watched both over and over again years later, Gladiator's the one that for me gets better and better the more I watch it.
Like, it's Braveheart, shorter. I think that's why.
Yeah. And Braveheart, I think, still holds up, but over time, my taste has shifted more towards Gladiator. So, I guess if Traffic wasn't nominated that year, I'm fine with Gladiator winning, but the fact that it beat Traffic is a little strange.
And everyone gets upset that Traffic is nominated and not the Aronofsky film, Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, that was the same that year, was that if you see one drug movie this year, see Requiem.
Yeah.
That's how Requiem even promoted itself.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it not being nominated. I like Requiem, but I thought Traffic was a much better film.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
The next time we come up, this is in 2001, and I just want to say that the last three films, American Beauty, Gladiator, and Beautiful Mind, all won by Universal DreamWorks. Just something interesting. I just looked over when I was watching these. So Beautiful Mind wins for Best Film 2001 over Gosford Park, In the Bedroom, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, and Moulin Rouge.
Nick actually shuddered as he said that. Just really.
My body actually recoiled. We're talking about Beautiful Mind in the scope of true stories versus, you know, how you can change a biopic to suit the emotional needs of the viewer. Mm-hmm. then that's Beautiful Mind is basically a lie.
Yeah, it's one of the worst examples of that. Well, I guess you could argue worst and best, because it's a horrible adaption of John, I'm blanking on his name.
Not the only one.
The character Russell Crowe plays, John Nash. It's John a terrible Nash. Adaption of John Nash's biography and what his life, how his life actually was, facts wise. But it's a great film.
It's a great movie. Yeah.
So, and I actually think that's a weak year for best. Like, I think I've seen all those. I mean, for me, I'd say Fellowship.
I don't think I saw it in the bedroom.
I saw Marissa Tomei, Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah, Gosford Park was weak, and that I love Robert Altman. Gosford Park was really weak.
I like Gosford. Like, they're all good movies, but in terms of Best Picture,
Moulin Rouge. But that's just because you love Moulin Rouge, and I hate Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah,
and I evidently you convinced Manny to give it another chance.
I would say Fellowship for that year, but that's only because I think Fellowship is the best of the trilogy, so one of them's going to win. It should have been that.
I 100% agree. And I think Fellowship of the Rings is the best film in the trilogy. And I think the only reason why it didn't win, because everyone knew they were going to give the last one the award.
Let's see if this gets better.
Exactly. And it didn't. Well, I shouldn't say that. They're all very good films. Fellowship is just I think Fellowship reaches its goal better. I think it's better. It's even though it ends on a cliffhanger, it's emotionally... it leaves you fulfilled emotionally.
Yeah.
I think Fellowship is a better movie than Beautiful Mind. I'm fine with Beautiful Mind winning, but I think Fellowship's a better film.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't even know how you can compare because of the scale of the movies.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at when it went into Fellowship and the fact that they were shooting all three of those at the same time, and just taking Fellowship alone as a film, the scale of it compared to A Beautiful Mind is... it's also more, it's a perfect mix of old school Hollywood movie making mixed with new technology Hollywood filmmaking, much like Gladiator was.
Yeah.
Now I'm just seeing moments from Fellowship in my head, and there's just so many. I think the greatest moments of that trilogy, most of them come from Fellowship.
Was that the same year as Ali? 2001?
I think it was, yeah.
I am surprised that Ali is not on this list, looking back on it now.
Yeah, I'm surprised too.
Because, Ali is another one where Michael Mann invented technology.
Yep.
For that film. But it's not on the list, we can't talk about it. But I think I would put Ali over the movie I didn't see in the bedroom.
Yeah, Ali's certainly a better film than in the bedroom is.
2002, Chicago was the winner, but the other ones were Gangs of New York, The Hours, Lord of the Rings, and The Pianist. I'm okay with Chicago. I like Chicago. I think The Pianist is a better film.
Yeah, and I'm sure it is, given it's Polanski and Adrian Brody won. I've never seen it. But I would say, I think Gangs of New York is, again, scale-wise, you have to give it the better film score to Gangs of New York over Chicago.
See, we were talking about Goodfellas before and how movies fall apart.
Gangs
in New York falls apart. Yeah.
More so, I think out of, I don't know, because Casino, I see what you're saying with Casino. I love Gangs, and I know I give Gangs more credit, and I love it more than I should, because it's far from DiCaprio's best work.
Yeah.
It's
visually very different than anything Scorsese
does. I like Diaz in it, but I can never really decide if she's miscast or not, but I actually like her in it. It's really, for me, it's the opening of Liam Neeson and Daniel Day-Lewis in a showdown, and then Daniel Day-Lewis carrying the movie. And that final shot is one of the greatest shots in film history, let alone in Scorsese's filmography. But I definitely tend to give it more credit than it's probably worthy of. So for me, I would go with Gangs of New York, but I fully realize that probably shouldn't be the way it is.
The next 2 years, Return of the King wins, finally. And Million Dollar Baby wins. I have no problem with either of those two films.
Million Dollar Baby...
It was against Avatar.
Yeah, The Aviator.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, but God almighty. Yeah, so that's The Aviator.
Again, basically any year Scorsese's got something nominated, I think it should win.
I thought The Aviator was better than Gangs of New York.
But I think that's another weak year overall when you look at what's nominated.
Yeah, Finding Neverland. Like, what the fuck?
Million Dollar Babies, that blows my mind, Finding Neverland. Million Dollar Babies, a movie that I saw, I enjoyed, and I've never gone back to revisit, and I don't feel a strong urge to. And you know what? Honestly, we're going to get to it in a minute. The reason why is because it's been sullied for me by Crash, because it's the same writer.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, it's Paul Haggis. So I shudder. The only thing I purposely go back and rewatch and love unabashedly that Paul Haggis has had anything to do with is Casino Royale. And other than that, it's like you're talking about the writer and creator of Texas Ranger. and you're going to give him two best pictures, basically. That Grant Eastwood directed Million Dollar Baby, which is why I give it the credit. But
do you think with the Academy, because I remember a big thing with Million Dollar Baby was... big thing with Million Dollar Baby is that it was a great film and that it won. But I remember with Unforgiven, people didn't think it was a great film at the time. I remember reading that a lot, that people didn't think it should have won Best Film, but it was going to because of Eastwood. Do you think that that if they had known he would come out with Million Dollar Baby years later, that they would have given it to Unforgiven?
I hope not, because I still think Unforgiven is his best film as a director.
Really?
Yeah, I just watched Unforgiven. The Blu-ray just came out like 2 weeks ago, and I just rewatched it. And the commentary on, what makes a man, on, morality, everything else that goes into Unforgiven.
I need to watch Unforgiven again, then.
I actually think by far it's Eastwood's best director.
Really?
And I really need to watch it again. Because to me, being a kid, 12-year-old kid when Unforgiven came out, I didn't see it till years later, but I remember that year and all the buildup. And, of course I knew who Clint Eastwood was, but I'd maybe seen Dirty Harry on TV.
Yeah.
I hadn't really gotten into Eastwood's films yet. But then, to me at the time, it was like, oh, it's because he's a really famous actor who directed a movie. That's why there's all this hype around it. And then you go back, and Eastwood had been directing movies for 20 years.
Yeah.
It was just that he finally went from directing, more action or kind of 80s set piece, probably still action movies, and kind of the movies he was well known for, to directing a fantastic Western that is, there's so much going on thematically within Unforgiven that it goes far beyond just the Western aspect of it. Now I know that's why it won. But at the time, I can remember just being like, oh, it's just because he directed a movie and it must be really good. And, that was a movie that knocked me on my ass when I first saw it.
I need to watch it again.
I was probably 14 when I first saw it.
Yeah.
And continually, the screenplay, everything about Unforgiven, I continue to defend as Eastwood's best film as a director.
Which unfortunately brings us to the worst film ever to win the Best Picture Award.
Yep.
In our mind, Crash.
Yep.
And let's look what Crash won against. Crash won against Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Good Night and Good Luck, and Munich. And I have not seen Good Night and Good Luck, but I still wonder how Crash
every single won. One of those films is... let's break it down. Those other four films, all of them I would label as great. They're all great films. Mm-hmm. All worthy of being nominated Best Picture. I would actually say any one of them, any other year, I wish they were all nominated in different years so they all could win Best Picture. Because to me, they're all worthy of that title. Crash is such a piece of shit movie. It really is. It's just a piss poor commentary on race relations.
Yeah.
And it's for me, it's a movie that And I'm not saying everyone that likes is racist, because there are people that love Crash that I talk to, and I know they're not racist. But for me, it's a movie that allows racist people to feel better about their racism, because they're, it's like, I
posted, well, everyone else feels this way.
Right. Yeah. I posted the quote when you and I were discussing it on Facebook about it. I'm looking to get the quote because I won't do it justice, but it basically uses stereotypes to tell the story about stereotypes. Like, yeah. It's not breaking new ground.
Not even good storytelling.
No, it's terrible. And yeah. It's the best example of the most egregious use of, I guess, manipulation of emotion that I've ever seen in a film. Ever. And for that, the moment I saw it, I checked out of the movie, because I was just like, this, granted, movies are supposed to manipulate you emotionally.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. But it should be done in a way where you don't even realize it.
Yeah.
And when you realize that your emotions are purposely being manipulated, that's shitty writing to me.
Yeah.
And
I would say in Crash, there's a point in there that there could have been a good movie.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a good movie in there somewhere.
You just need somebody create Walker, Texas
writing
Ranger.
Or editing or wherever it went wrong somewhere. I'm speechless.
Yeah.
Because it really is terrible.
You have fantastic actors in there. Yeah. I mean, Don Cheadle, Terrence Howard, Matt Dillon is, I mean, I know he got nominated that year.
Yeah.
I mean, he's certainly capable of being a very strong actor. I don't think that's the best example of it. Ryan Phillippe.
Yeah.
And then you've got Sandra Bullock and Brendan Fraser, but
you know, the part with the, you know, it's stereotypes for the sake of being stereotypes.
Yeah, and that's exactly.
And
it's not even
smartly done. It's not clever. Like,
not at all.
You know, when I watched it for the first time, and I remember seeing the scene with Ludacris, and I forget his cohort, his actor's name.
Oh, yeah.
But I've seen him in stuff. Like, I think, okay, this is going to be a very interesting, this could be maybe what saves the film. And then they say, look, they're afraid of us. Well, they should be afraid of us, because we got guns. Let's rob them.
Yeah.
Like, you don't make an argument and then prove yourself. That doesn't make a good story. If you make an argument with the character, and then you fool everyone by saying, but see, he really is who he says he is, man.
Right. And that's,
like, it's not clever and it's not good. It's stupid.
I just found the quote. And it, for a movie about race and stereotypes, Crash is both simplistically black and white and loaded with characters who are themselves stereotypes.
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to. It somehow pulled the wool over almost everyone's eyes. Certainly the Academy. I guess it just made them feel better that
someone made a movie about race relations.
Yeah, like,
didn't end with someone being hung.
And that was one that we'll get to in a few minutes when we get to the year, but that was one that I saw early on. It wasn't released, if I recall correctly, it was not released during Oscar season. It was more of a spring, early summer opening.
Crash?
I think so. If I remember correctly, I could be wrong. But I remember seeing it in the theater, you know, as I said, totally being taken out of it because of how overly manipulative it was with its writing. And execution.
It's insulting.
Yeah, it really is insulting. In the middle of the movie, and it's, I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't seen it.
Let's ruin
the storyline with the gun and his young daughter. And I just remember just being outraged at how lazy and just manipulative it is. Because it is, it's insulting that anyone who's...
And like, it's almost saying it's okay to be mean to people. Like, because no one in that film, like, any part of that film, like, if someone just makes a right decision, a conscious decision, like, if the locksmith, you know, takes the store owner back to the door and see, it's not the lock, it's the door.
Right.
Like, there are all these little moments in it that, you know, but even saying, like, that's the point, it's because they didn't take those little moments and utilize them. Like, no, because no human, like, it's hard for me to believe, like, maybe I just think too good of people. Then no one, like, some guy wouldn't go out of his way to try to help someone. Or, you know, this brotherhood of cops is so ingrained that he's going to watch Matt Dillon raped Tandy Newton.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, that story they never get back to. Like, not only does, like, he assault her, and then he saves her life, they never go back to him saving her. Like, that's the end of that storyline. Yeah. Like, no, like, that's a storyline you can keep on telling. And I feel like all the subsidiary stories, The Locksmith I thought was a great story they could tell. And I thought if they did more with the Ludacris storyline, that and the how it moves in with Ryan Phillippe's storyline,
yep.
I thought that was really good, and that could have been, like, a really interesting film. But instead, they just say, nope, what you see is what you get. There's no deeper meaning here except that people suck.
Yeah, and as you said it perfectly, it's just insulting. And I was insulted as I was watching the movie, and then when it came Oscar time and the nominations came out, I was shocked to see not only get nominated for Best Picture, but all, like, some of the performance ones, I guess I would be okay with, but to see how many nominations it ended up getting, and then the buzz surrounding it that it was actually going to win over
Brokeback Mountain, Capote, or Munich.
Yeah.
I thought Capote was the best film of that year. I mean, I didn't see Brokeback until a couple years later. So, like, I can't, you know.
I actually think I saw all of those in the theater that year. I mean, I still remember when Crash was announced, I was shocked when they announced Best Picture.
I like Capote a lot. I thought Capote was a great film.
Yeah, any one of those. And now that I'm looking back on it, I mean, we're coming up on Crash is almost
10
years old.
Yeah.
What has Paul Haggis done since in terms of directing?
Been on Entourage a few times.
He's done a TV show. He's done In the Valley of Elah, which I think got a few Oscar nominations, but nobody saw. Like, it was came and gone in days. And then The Next 3 Days, which was Russell Crowe and Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
I mean, you win Best Director, Best Picture, and in the next 8 years, you make basically 2 movies, both of which... I haven't seen In the Valley of Elah, but I've heard it's not very good. And the next
what Bond film did he make?
Huh?
What Bond film did he make?
He wrote Casino Royale. I mean, these are. I'm just going what he directed. Okay. Writing, he's written much more. He wrote Quantum of Solace, too. He wrote Flags of Our Fathers, Million Dollar Baby, Walker, Texas Ranger, The Last Kiss.
Why? He wrote The Last Kiss?
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean...
Have we vented enough about Crash? Because I feel maybe we need to go on before
we
swallow ourselves in hate for Crash. 2006, The Departed wins. I like The Departed a lot. Obviously, it's Scorsese. It's Boston. It's Damon. It's DiCaprio. It's 98%. I think it kind of falls apart like the rest of his later 3 films. But I liked The Departed. I'm happy that he won an Oscar for it. It's not the film that I think he should have won the Oscar for. I remember that year I was really pulling for either Little Miss Sunshine or Babel, however you say it.
Yeah, I mean, that year I was pulling for The Departed, so, and I'm still okay.
I was okay with it.
I could never get on the Babel bandwagon. there's good performances, but that was a movie that was just, to me, the hype around it, and I think... I mean, I wanted to like it more than I did, and I walked out just really disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Little Miss Sunshine, but it's
trying. I think it was a weak year.
Comedy and
yeah, I think it was a weak year because in between those are Letters of Iwo Jima and The Queen.
Yeah, I actually think it was a pretty weak year.
And I like The Queen, but I mean, The Departed's better than The Queen. 2007, we're okay with No Country for Old Men winning.
Yep.
2008, we're okay with Slumdog Millionaire. I still haven't seen Slumdog, so I don't know. I think I was really, 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 really... I love The Reader. I thought The Reader was a magnificent film.
Yeah, The Reader was really good.
And I think I was really pulling for that, even over Fincher's Benjamin Button. But Slumdog won. I still haven't seen Slumdog. 2009, we're both okay with The Hurt Locker?
Not really, but...
Oh, wait, okay, that's right. I'm okay with The Hurt Locker. You.
Yeah, I mean, I like The Hurt Locker, but I just... It's a movie that I think the beginning and ending are the highlights, and in between is just kind of a war movie that's good, but I don't And I love Kathryn Bigelow as a director. But I just don't... To me, I never understood. It was another one. It came out in spring. I saw it in the theater. And by the time Oscar time rolled around, I was shocked at the nominations and the hype around it for Oscars. Because I don't get it.
Do you think Up in the Air was a better film to win?
Up in the Air was my favorite film of that year.
Really? Better than Glorious Bastards?
Yeah. Yeah. Glorious Bastards... And it's kind of funny that I'm going to knock Tarantino for me, Inglourious Bastards has a moment towards the end that just goes so far over the top. It doesn't ruin the movie, but it ruined its chance of being my favorite film for that year. Because for me, I mean, saying Tarantino goes over the top should be obvious, but it's in the theater when they just start shooting everyone. That was too much for me, even for Tarantino standards.
So it wasn't so much that it was historically inaccurate was the problem.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, that's the movie where...
Well, no, that was the big thing with the film when it came out, is why there was I remember being quite a lot of backlash against it.
Right.
Because Hitler is in this movie theater, and that's how he died. I'm like, don't you people understand that this is the way... Like, he's not disparaging World War II or the memory of any of the Holocaust survivors. This is the way I think we all wished Hitler died.
Right.
In
and
a
that's
bloodbath.
I always attributed the ending of Inglourious Basterds in general to like an issue of Marvel's What If.
Yeah.
And that's what Tarantino by no means was saying this is how World War II was.
Yeah.
And I think people just like if you thought that, it had to be somebody who didn't see the movie because I don't think it's set up to be a true story. And so I wouldn't even call it revisionist history. I would call it a alternate universe version of World War II.
Mm-hmm. At the time I put Inglourious Basterds at 3 on my list. That was the first year Ryan and I did
the top
list. And I think I put the 3 underneath Hurt Locker and Up. I started Up in the Air a couple years later and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Even the twist towards the end, like, it didn't surprise me, really.
Yeah,
no, not saying I didn't get it, I got it. But it just, maybe because I didn't see it amongst all the hype for it.
Yeah.
That it just didn't grab me, like the other films did. I finally just saw Precious last year. ironically, talking about films I haven't seen before. 2010, The King's Speech wins. But you could make a very, very, very strong argument for a Social Network. And I think this is the other one we talked about earlier that we disagreed on. I need to see The King's Speech again.
I need to rewatch it too.
And and really, because I've watched Social Network recently, and I remember thinking after watching The Social Network, how did that not win? And I was rooting for The King's Speech, and I'm fine with The King's Speech winning Best Picture. But, like, upon watching Social Network again, how did it not win?
Yeah.
And, even if you take in the size of scope of how the budget and how the movies are put together, they're yin and yang. And they're both done flawlessly.
Yeah.
And when you think about the size of the Social Network, how did it not win? And saying that, I'm fine with... I'm emotionally fine with The King's Speech winning.
For me, this is the exact same as Private Ryan and Shakespeare in Love.
It's very similar, actually.
Yeah, these are the two that... and for me, it comes down to... And again, well, I'll just say this. It comes down to, in 25, 50 years, the movie that is going to be remembered more, I think, will be Saving Private Ryan and The Social Network over Shakespeare in Love and The King's Speech for historical reasons, for film history reasons. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I walked out of The Social Network and I said to my girlfriend, in 20 years, that's a movie that people are going to look back on and say, you know, that's where this actor got started. Or look at that movie. All these actors were in it together. Because I really think between Jesse Eisenberg,
Rooney Mara.
Yeah, Rooney Mara, Armie Hammer, and oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. Andrew Garfield. Mm. Those are four of the A-list actors of tomorrow.
Yeah.
If Armie Hammer doesn't screw it up with Mirror Mirror, which just looks horrible.
He's the only reason I want to see the movie.
He's the only reason I would see it, but I'm not sitting through that movie. After that first trailer is one of the worst trailers it's I've awful. Ever seen for a movie.
We're going to talk about bad trailers for future movies in a future podcast.
But anyway, so for me, it comes down to that. And it's granted, you can say, yeah, but that's something that's too far down the line. But, I mean, it was talked about when Ryan came out how important that movie was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Social Network, too. It's a moment captured in time. I mean, it really is a time capsule. Whether, granted, not everything that the Social Network has to say about that, the history of Facebook is true, and it's more of a fiction version of how Facebook came to be. But in terms of the Facebook generation and what Facebook has done to our culture and everything else surrounding Facebook, that's the importance of the Social Network. And it's a film that captures all of that perfectly.
And I think what you just said, I think that's the reason why the King's Speech was given that edge, was the fact that they didn't need to. I remember saying this with Ryan now that we're having this discussion. They didn't need to make anything up about the King's Speech. Like, that King's Speech, like, from him not wanting to be king to, you know, talking with marbles in the mouth, that whole friendship between the two, like, that is, you know, we were talking before with biopics not necessarily being always 100% accurate, but it's more accurate than the Social Network. Well, even than the Social Network. I mean, I understand what Sorkin is doing, and I love that he did it. By bookmarking the film, bookending the film with him breaking up with his girlfriend and him trying to reattach with her via Facebook. Like, I get it and I understand it. But I think that was the reason why I thought that the King's Speech just had one step over it. Was just that it didn't need to make up a beginning to it. And I'll agree with you. How Armie Hammer did not get nominated for Best Supporting Actor in that movie. Yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about snubs of actors, Mark that is Harvey the biggest too. One.
He didn't. I don't think he.
I don't think he got. No, he was. I think he was.
Was he?
I can't remember. But I
don't think he was because I thought was the biggest snub of the year for me.
Yeah, they got a lot of. I thought Armie Hammer, the fact that he was playing two different people, but still twins, so it's like the subtle differences that twins have within each other. I thought Armie Hammer was the best performance I had seen.
Well, it's really Armie Hammer's face on the second twist and somebody else's body. So,
but you know, that was Social Network versus King's Speech. And then this year, you heard our podcast. You knew what we wanted. At least I hope you heard the podcast. We were both really, really pulling for Hugo, and what won was The Artist.
Yep.
And I'm still not okay with it.
Neither am I, but.
It's still, I mean, I'm not going to go as far as the lady from Vertigo and say that it was raped, but I still think Hugo, or even The Descendants, is a better film than The Artist.
Yep, I would agree with both those. For me, it comes down to, again, story. And The Artist is so weak, and the story of both Hugo and The Descendants is so strong that, I mean... And Hugo is a spectacle. I mean, but at the core, it's got a very strong and imaginative story that weaves fiction and history and
seamlessly.
And The Descendants is just such an emotional screenplay and such an emotional story that
I feel like The Descendants was as perfect as a modern kind of like story of that can be.
Yep.
You know, I mean, there were, I mean, you could, if you want to be nitpicky, you could find nitpicky things about it, but as far as the way it was portrayed and the way it was written, it was as perfect as a modern story. It's a story. When you think about it, it's not a grandiose story. Like it's a very, I mean, they kind of put this unneeded pressure on them with having the land trust in his name.
Yep.
But, I mean, at the core, it's really about a guy and his family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the films that were nominated this year were parts of a broader picture, you know, with Midnight in Paris, The Moneyball, and Tree of Life, where at its core, in a sense, was a family story.
Yep.
And I think when you can make a family story that compelling, and if you can make people who don't cry in movies, like myself, cry twice during it... kudos to you. So that was our list of the films that should have won against the ones that unfortunately did. You know, I think what we learned a lot in this, we both hate Crash. And that a lot
That's
of
a lesson to take
that was a lesson to learn from this. If you've seen Crash, I'm sorry. If you haven't seen Crash, don't. Just pretend that something else won instead of Crash. So until next... Oh, and you want to check out our Facebook page. It's a Pizzcast blog. And I'll, you know, link it when I do my links. But we're going to be doing the March Madness of movies. I'm a huge college basketball fan, especially this time of year, because I start rooting for teams I've never heard of because they haven't beaten teams that I hate. And so I thought, I got creative one night and thought, let's do it with movies. So we have a list. We have I've set up brackets of 64 movies. They're going to battle head-to-head until we have a winner of Movie Madness, March Movie Madness, which I'm sure is somewhere I'm breaking some trademark law.
Probably.
For using March and Madness in the same sentence. But look forward to that. It's going to be on our Facebook page, so you can get all social media in. Until the next time, I'm Nick.
I'm Nick.
Good night, and good luck.